talking about bouncing from an earlier phase, rather I will be talking about replacing the Big Bang with creation from nothing, which is, I think, something that has to be addressed even if you have a bounce, because if you bounce from an earlier phase, you need to also explain where that earlier space-time is coming from. So this is work done with Joop and Neil, and published in these two papers mentioned down there. Now, we know that everything in cosmology is extremely sensitive on initial conditions, and this even if you have models which are actually classical attractors, like inflation or ekphorosis. And so we need to understand the initial conditions. Moreover, we would like to understand how space and time themselves arose. And so really we need some kind of theory to address this. Now, there's an old idea, which is very appealing, which is that that a closed universe might be able to just nucleate from nothing, because the closed universe has zero energy. And so it should be able to, this should be an allowed process. That's the idea. Now, the trouble is to, you know, this is, even Lemaître had similar kind of ideas. There's a paper from the 70s by Tryon. There's also a paper by Braut, Englert, and Gunzig, where they really explicitly stated these ideas. But the trouble was it's kind of hard. You know, it's not enough to just state the idea. You have to be able to calculate something. And the idea became more precise with the no boundary and the tunneling proposals, where the idea was really to consider the creation of the universe as a kind of a regular tunneling event from nothing. And the fact that this would be regular would allow you to actually calculate things. Now, the two proposals were formulated in rather different terms, but they're very closely related, as we will see. In particular, one formulation which is in a sense common to both is to start with a path integral over gravity and other matter in a mini superspace approach, and to try and describe this creation event by a saddle point of this path integral. Now, historically, there were at least two approaches to this. Essentially, the Euclidean approach, advocated by Hartle and Hawking, where the hope was that, in analogy with a weak rotation in quantum field theory, if you do such an Euclidean approach to gravity, you might be able to find better convergence property. And moreover, this might allow you to more easily incorporate topologically non-trivial manifolds. But there also, from the start, there were problems with this approach, in particular the conformal mode problem. So if you include gravity in your theory, the kinetic term for gravity has the opposite sign to the kinetic term for other matter. And this, in fact, instead of improving convergence, actually makes it worse, typically. Now, another thing which was also actually known from the very beginning, there's a paper by Gary Gibbons from the late 70s, is that topologically non-trivial manifolds have unbounded actions above and below. So if you include them, you will get anything. You will get plus infinity, minus infinity, anything you want. Now, on the other hand, Vilenkin rather advocated for a Lorentzian approach, where you have a highly oscillating integral. So you don't have the conformal mode problem, but it's also not clear whether the integral is actually well-defined, whether it actually converges. And in fact, the question of convergence of integrals was an open issue, really, in both approaches, as shown in quite some detail by Halliwell. Now, on this particular point, one can make progress by using Picard-Lefschetz theory, which is just a mathematical framework which is particularly well suited for dealing with oscillating integrals. And so it's ideally suited for any kind of Feynman path integral type situation. It's actually a bit surprising that this isn't used more widely, even in quantum field theory, because these tools are actually of obvious general use. So I will just briefly review how it works. The idea is that you take your integral and you view the integrand here, so I times the action divided by h bar, you extend it to the complex plane. You now view it as a complex, as a holomorphic function of its variables, which are complexified. So in other words, you complexify all of the fields. And then in this complex space, you can maybe, the idea is to try and find a contour to deform the original contour in such a way that you find a contour along which the integral is easier to evaluate. So it's sort of a sophisticated way of using Cauchy's theorem. In a sense, you could say that Cauchy's theorem tells us that, you know, as long as we don't cross singularities, contours can be deformed, and Picard-Lefschetz theory gives a more systematic way of just showing how it should be deformed.
But is the final answer supposed to be finite, or is it an approximation scheme that can
replicate? No, it will only work if the integral is actually convergent in the end. So it's designed for conditionally convergent integrals, and if the integral is actually convergent, it will give a finite answer. But it will also show, make it clear if an integral is just divergent from the start, and then there's nothing you can do. It's really just sort of an implementation of Cauchy's theorem, so there's nothing mysterious about it in that sense. And also nothing additional about it in that sense. You're not changing any mathematics. There's a nice review provided in Ed Witten's paper on Chern-Simons theory, where, well, even if you're not interested in Chern-Simons theory, there is a separate chapter just on Picard-Lefschetz theory, which is nice to read. Now, the idea is that we will rewrite the integrand in terms of real functions little h and capital H, where little h tells us the magnitude of the integrand and capital H the phase, right? Little h is also known as a Morse function. And it proves useful to look at the critical points of this Morse function. Now, the critical points of the Morse function, because it's a complex integral, are automatically saddle points of the action, and they're also critical points. So the critical points of the Morse function are, in fact, critical points of the entire integrand, which one can easily show. And moreover, these are, as I said, these are saddle points. So if we have such a critical point sigma, there will be directions in which the Morse function is decreasing.
You're assuming that now
that's right. Okay. Yes. And so then any critical point is a saddle point. Yeah.
Is there a subtlety into the choice of complex structure you put on the space of fields? I understand you deserve one dimension. There's no question.
Yeah, we will use it only in one dimension. You have to, in this complex field, you have to put a metric on this complex space.
And then, okay. So there's a freedom in that complex structure.
But
it
shouldn't affect the results. I guess you can choose this metric in a way that's convenient for you.
Yeah.
Because you will. It's just a way of evaluating the original integral that you're interested in. You're not actually changing that original integral. You're just you're rewriting it in a convenient manner.
You're extending it into some complex field.
Yes, which allows you to just deal with it more easily. Yeah. So here, because we're in one dimension, we'll just use the trivial metric, and yeah.
In one dimension.
Yeah, but it can be, it's formulated mathematically in any number of dimensions.
Finite.
And it might be tricky there, the right picture.
That may certainly be true, yes.
Witten has another paper where he explains that in the case where the Hamiltonian is zero,
Okay, so because these are saddle points, in some directions the Morse function will be decreasing, in other directions it will be increasing, and we can look at the paths of steepest ascent and descent. Okay, these paths are can be obtained by writing down an equation like this, where we're looking at, you know, just the directions in which this Morse function is increasing or decreasing. And an interesting property is that the phase function capital H is constant along such paths of steepest ascent and descent. And this makes it easy to find these paths, right? So here, these downward flow lines are called J, denoted by J, and the upward flows by K. And they partition this complex plane now into regions in which the amplitude of the integrand is lower than at the critical point. These are the green regions, and regions where the amplitude is bigger than at the critical point. These are the red regions. And the idea then is simply that if we deform the contour such that it lies on a curve of steepest descent, the integral will in a sense be maximally convergent. Right, so really what we're doing is we have an integral which is oscillating a lot with a large amplitude, and we want to rewrite it as something which is non-oscillating. And then the amplitude will have to be evidently smaller. We'll have to flow down to these contours, because we have oscillations where we have cancellations between different contributions. If we rewrite it into something which is non-oscillating, the magnitude of it, this will have to be lower. There's a way of formulating this more precisely. Oh, I should say, so the integral along, so these paths of steepest descent are called the Lefschetz thimbles. And so along such a thimble, the integral will be of this kind of general shape. And then we can, in fact, easily approximate the integral using the saddle point approximation along such a thimble. And so the idea will be to rewrite the whole original integral as a sum of integrals over such thimbles. Then there's one remaining point which needs to be clarified, which is which of these thimbles actually contribute to the integral. Because there could be, in general, very many such thimbles. And we need to know which ones are actually relevant. So what we want to do is we want to rewrite the original integration contour C as a sum over these Lefschetz thimbles J sigma with some coefficient n sigma, which can be 0 or 1 depending on whether the thimble contributes or not. And assuming an orientation of the thimble which is in line with the orientation of the original contour. Now, you see, if that equation, if we just so I should explain this relation first. In the general case, the lines of steepest ascent and descent only intersect at one single critical point. So if there are no degeneracies, this will be true. So let me just assume for now that it is true, and there's a subtlety to which we'll come later on to show how one deals with this when it's not true. So one can define this intersection pairing that J sigma and K tau only intersect when sigma is equal to tau. And using this, you can just multiply the equation above here by K, by a line of steepest ascent, to show that really these numbers n are just given by the intersections of the original integration contour with the lines of steepest ascent. This is another way of saying what I was showing earlier here, is that we, from the original integration contour, must be flowed down to one along which the down to a thimble which is relevant. So, all the thimbles which are relevant are those which can be reached by flowing down from the original integration contour. So there might be other thimbles elsewhere which are inaccessible by that procedure, and those are then irrelevant. Yes.
But given a contour C, do you know that it can be written in this form in terms of superposition symbols?
Yeah. Well, it could be the case that there is no saddle point at all, and then it cannot.
Many
but
saddle points, and can you actually take the contour and deform it such that it actually goes through each thimble?
I think.
Yes.
Well,
any convergence integral can be.
Well, the endpoints are fixed.
The endpoints, yes, the endpoints of the integral are fixed, and so you will then just flow it down until you reach.
I think he's asking a
such
question.
A
it's an homology question. You have a basis of homology KT, and then whether this basis is complete or not, But it might be, you have to look at.
I think there might be exceptions where there is simply no good saddle point approximation. You know, so when in flowing down, you never encounter a saddle point. So there might be saddle points elsewhere, but which are irrelevant. But it might be, you might think of such an example, that's true. In that case, you just have to evaluate the integral some other way. Right, then this is just not a useful method. Doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the integral, it just means you cannot evaluate it by this method.
Well, it means that the integral is more than exponentially suppressed. So
yeah, it's going to be very difficult to evaluate.
Exponentially,
it.
It's of exponentially suppressed. So it's kind of like,
Yeah, well...
I mean, if you flow down and you never hit a saddle
yes.
point...
Yes,
it
must be quite...
The integral
yes.
is getting smaller,
smaller
and smaller.
Than any exponential.
It must be enormously small,
yeah.
Exactly. So you probably don't have to worry about it.
Is there a statement that the square bracket equation, is that an exact statement, or is that an asymptotic series like a saddle point normally is at the right-hand side?
Sorry, this one here?
No, the thing inside the box. So the, I'm not sure how to parse it right.
This is an exact expression.
That's an exact expression.
That's an exact expression. It's just saying the integral can be written as a sum over thimbles. Along each thimble, the phase is constant, so you can pull it out of the integral, because that's by definition of this steepest descent path. And then you just perform the integral along the steepest descent path of the Morse function. Yeah, that's all precise. But in practice, you would then be able to evaluate these last integrals by a saddle point approximation.
And an asymptotic
expansion. And an expansion, yes. But as it stands, this formula is exact. OK, so we want to apply this to gravity coupled to a cosmological constant. In the mini-superspace approximation, where we assume cosmological symmetry of the metric, now, if you use the standard metric like this, minus n squared dt squared plus a squared d omega 3 squared, then, the action reduces to the following form. Here, d omega 3 squared is just the spatial 3 section, which can be closed, flat, or open, although we'll mostly be interested in the closed case here. The curvature of the spatial section is denoted by the little k.
Are you interested in closed case because of compact topology or because
of K? Well, we're doing the closed case because we're ultimately interested in the no-boundary proposal, which only works. You can only have a regular Euclidean metric if K is 1. So that's the reason. But the formalism works for any K. So at the beginning, I think I have K general, and then at some point I will specialize to K equals plus 1.
But the formalism works for any K, assuming compact spatial topology or not.
Oh, you mean because the integrals will become infinite? The integral over the volume will become infinite. Yes, so I think it's cleaner to assume a compact spatial topology. Yeah, so you could consider a torus or some hyperbolic space where you make identifications. Yeah.
But you are in the Lorentzian framework.
That's right.
So you said you mentioning that the Euclidean thing is well defined only for a compact topology.
No, I haven't said yet that anything about the Euclidean formulation. I will come back to that.
You briefly did.
Did I? Oh, sorry.
That's why I got a little confused.
Oh, I
don't.
It should become clear later.
Using it as a motivation.
That was my motivation. I'm saying, yeah, people looked at the Euclidean and at the Lorentzian one. I will start with the Lorentzian one, and then this will make it clear later on why the Euclidean one is actually ill-defined.
What you mentioned is you chose k equals plus 1 in order to make contact
with the I'm sorry. That's right. Yes. So, okay, I should say that. Yes, I will also make that clearer. The defining integral is Lorentzian. But the saddle points of that integral can be complex in general and can contain Euclidean sections. And the idea of the no boundary proposal inherently rests on the fact that a closed Euclidean section can be regular. So that's the more precise way of saying it. Right, so if we just take the normal standard metric, this integral is hard to deal with. The equations of motion are hard to solve, and there is a more useful form of the metric, which was advocated by Halliwell in the 80s, which is the following one. You call Q the scale factor squared, and you just take your time component to be given by minus n squared over Q of t. So this is not, this doesn't, this form of the metric doesn't have any particular physical significance. It just makes the mathematics much simpler, because it actually makes the action quadratic in Q. So the action reduces to just this Q dot squared kinetic term for the scale factor squared. And the cosmological constant term also involves just a single power of Q. So this is leads to extremely simple equations of motion. The equation of motion is just Q double dot is given by 2 lambda over 3 n squared, where n is the Laplace function. And the Laplace function here is assumed to be a constant. So
by the way, this is what we do in local gravity, where we use densitized triads and inverse density Laplace. This is exact, but in general.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, then you should agree.
What about the measure of derivation? Is there a logarithmic potential that you create when you change the parameter?
Yes, so in principle, you have to, of course, be careful to do all that. Since ultimately we'll be interested in the saddle point approximation, these factors make little difference.
Yeah, they're just normalized.
Yeah, but of course, yeah. But in principle, one should include all of these, that's right. And the constraint is given by this relation here. So the strategy that we'll adopt will be to solve the Q equation of motion. Let me say it differently. In order to perform the integral over the scale factor, what we'll do is we'll write a general solution Q of t as a particular background solution Q bar of t, which will be some fixed form, which in fact this will be a solution of the classical equation of motion, plus some fluctuation capital Q. So this is just shifting the variable of integration. But it actually makes the integral tractable. So it turns out that because the equation of motion is so simple, it can be solved. It's just a quadratic in t. And the boundary conditions here are that we're letting the universe evolve from an initial scale factor q0 to a final scale factor q1. Now, if we put this into the integral over Q, then the integral over the capital Q fluctuations just becomes a Gaussian integral, which can be performed. And in fact, it will just yield a prefactor to the integral over the Laplace. So it gives this factor of 1 over square root of n, for instance. So then we're simply left with an ordinary integral over the Laplace function. It's this integral here, dn over square root of n times this background action S0, which is given by which has the following form. So it has a term cubic in n, linear, and inversely proportional to n. And for this integral, we will now use the Picard-Lefschetz method to evaluate it, right? Because the integral of the scale factor could just be done explicitly, then we're simply left with the integral over the Laplace function. That's the only integral we're left that we have to deal with. And so first we need to know where the critical points lie. So then it's a quick calculation to see that there are 4 critical points at these locations here. And these can be real or complex depending on the signs that one, so depending on the boundary conditions, depending on both what kind of spatial section I'm choosing and what kind of boundary conditions I want to calculate the propagator from, over, sorry. What kind of scale factors I want to calculate the propagator for. So one can check that this makes sense by first looking at classical boundary conditions. From now on I will specialize to the closed spatial sections, k equals plus 1. Now the closed, the Sitter space is a hyperboloid, and as I choose the scale factor to be bigger than the waist of the hyperboloid, that is what I mean by a classical boundary condition. If one imposes the scale factor to be smaller than the waist of the hyperboloid, one will force the inclusion of geometries that are not purely real. Right, so, but, so first we can look at classical boundary conditions, meaning that the scale factor both initially and on the initial and on the final hypersurface is bigger than the waist of the hyperboloid.
Sorry, just to say, k equal 1 is spherical, hyperboloid is hyperboloid.
K equals plus 1 is a closed spherical spatial section.
Okay. That's the one you're looking at.
That's the one I'm going to look at, yes.
Okay. And you, what were you saying here about the
waist? What I'm saying is if you, I'm saying the embedding of four-dimensional de Sitter in five-dimensional is as a hyperboloid.
Yes, sure. Okay. Yeah.
And there's a waist here where the scale factor A is 3 over lambda. Now, so as long as I choose the scale factor to be bigger than 3 over lambda.
Q is 3 over lambda. Q, square root of.
Sorry.
Q is a squared.
Yes, that's right. Now, if I choose the scale factors to be the initial and final one, let's say I go from here to here, then this is classical. But if you were to choose something smaller than square root of 3 over lambda, you would force the path integral to consider non-real geometries as being relevant to this.
And this is because you're only allowing cosmology of constant and no matter field.
That's right, yes. It's this very simplest setting. Now, so in this case of classical boundary conditions, this is the complex n plane. Now, the saddle points in orange here all lie on the real n line, as expected. And so we again have the situation that these saddle points partition the plane into regions of convergence and divergence. I mean, in terms of, you know, regions where the integrand becomes smaller than at the critical point and regions in red where it becomes larger. Now, since we're looking at the Lorentzian integral, really what we want to integrate over is real positive n values. And it's easy to see that this integral can be deformed into this red dotted one, which lies as much as possible on the Lefschetz thimbles. In fact, strictly speaking, one would go from here down towards infinity and come back up along this one. Okay, and then along each of these two thimbles, we have a nicely convergent integral.
You just mentioned in passing that as one would expect, they lie on the real axis. Why? I'm just missing something here.
Because I'm using classical boundary conditions.
Oh.
So that one gets. One would expect the dominant geometries to be real solutions.
So they're both bigger than the waist. You can have both in the upper part or in the
right. So the reason why there are two saddle points is that I want to go from this radius to this one. But there's a second possibility, which is that I have the same radius again here. Right. So I can either go from this one to the final one or from this one to the final one. Right, and these will both be possibilities that contribute to the path integral. Okay, so there's nothing. Then one gets two phase factors for these two possible evolutions, and there's nothing mysterious about it. Good. Then the case which I'm really interested in is the no boundary case, where we let that initial geometry shrink to zero size. Now, we would also, in fact, want the initial geometry to be regular, but this is not something that we can immediately impose because it's quantum theory, and so you cannot impose, and in order to have regularity, you would need to impose a condition on the derivative of the scale factor. But we're already imposing that we want the original scale factor A to be zero, so we cannot also impose something on its derivative simultaneously. However, the integral over the Laplace function will automatically enforce the constraint equation, and so it will then enforce that actually at the saddle points the geometry will be regular. So this is something we get for free in that sense, and this provides a nice definition of the no boundary proposal. So here are the paths of steepest ascent and descent for the case with no boundary condition. I'm just showing this because I like the colors, and here's the explanation. Now the four saddle points are all complex. There's one subtlety here. It turns out that the path of steepest ascent from this saddle point coincides with the path of steepest descent from this one. So we actually have a situation which is degenerate, where these two paths are equal to each other. And but this can easily be resolved by adding a small complex deformation to the action, and then taking the limit where that deformation goes to zero again. And it turns out that it doesn't matter which complex deformation you choose. In the limit that it goes to zero, the results are unambiguous. So here's an example of what happens if you do that. So if you add such a small complex deformation, you see this is now the path of steepest ascent from this saddle point. But now instead of reaching the other saddle point, it turns around and goes back over here. So now these lines do not actually... now this path does not actually cross the other saddle point anymore. You would have to use the same kind of picture also for the lower saddle point separately, where it would just be the upside down picture, right? So now you cannot show them again on the same plot at the same time. But this then gets, so this makes it unambiguous that one can do all the calculations in this slightly deformed setting where there's just one intersection every time. And then the consequence of this is that we can, this original integration contour along the real real time axis just gets, you have to flow it down, which means along this K1 line onto this J1 Lefschetz thimble here. And so this means that there's just a single saddle point that actually contributes to this no boundary propagator. Even though we had initially four possible ones. One has to be careful that this is actually really truly convergent. So one should verify that these arcs at near zero and near infinity actually give you a vanishing contribution to the integral, just to make sure that we haven't made any mistake. And the asymptotic form of the action in both cases guarantees that this is the case. So then one can just evaluate the propagator, and it's given by the following formula. So it has a certain phase factor, which varies more and more as the universe expands, as Q1 gets bigger. This is as expected in terms of if we go at a late time classical universe. But interestingly, it also has a constant prefactor, which shows a suppression, e to the minus 12 pi squared over h bar lambda. So it shows a suppression depending on the value of the cosmological constant.
I just wanted to go back to Cliff's question, because at that time you said that there is an exact formula which you did approximate. So do you not have an exact formula? You only have the approximation?
Well, the exact formula would be the integral over this full Lefschetz thimble.
Right.
But now this integral over the Lefschetz thimble, I'm approximating it by the saddle point approximation. And so in writing this, what I've done is just take the saddle point value itself, which is the exponential, and then the prefactor coming from integrating over quadratic fluctuations around the saddle point. And then, of course, you can keep going if you want to have it more precisely.
But we could calculate, right, in principle?
In principle, you can just...
So I could just ask the computer to do it and then compare.
Yes. In fact, in this special case, I even know what the full solution is. It's given by a product of area functions.
Okay.
Because it's clear that looking at the Wheeler-DeWitt equation,
right,
that these are solutions. But it might be difficult to see exactly that this is an approximation to an area function,
exactly.
Right? This
exactly.
Way, yeah.
So the approximation is just h bar goes to zero, or h bar lambda goes to zero? What
only h bar goes to zero. Lambda is sort of a fixed parameter here.
There's also a truncation to the mini superspace approximation.
Yes. Yes.
So that throws away all the ultraviolet effects, which would be the thing that would lead you to think of higher curvatures and think of a curvature expansion. So
right, but the curvature is never very high here.
Well, the average curvature is never very high, but the worry is that the fluctuations in curvature are large.
Yeah, well, I will come to the fluctuations momentarily.
This is coming.
But you'll do it in a space, in a momentum dependent or a position dependent way. It won't be just mini superspace.
Exactly. Just I'm looking at, yes. Different Fourier modes on this, yeah. Now this prefactor turns out to be the inverse of the one that Hartle and Hawking had advocated, and it's actually it agrees with the one that Vilenkin claimed was the result for the tunneling proposal. But this proof, you know, the sign here, so what Hartley and Hawking had would have been an e to the plus 12 pi squared over h by lambda. But it's clear from the definition that this must be the correct sign, because we have to we know that the original action is real, and so its Morse function is zero. And we must flow down to get a manifestly convergent path integral. So it must become a negative exponent. And also this makes sense physically, because it means that it's easier to nucleate a small universe than to nucleate a huge universe. So when one looks at this, at these flow lines.
I'm sorry, what are you saying? Lambda zero means it's exponentially suppressed,
right?
So yes, and this would be an extremely large universe.
Okay, so
yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Whereas for the Hartle-Hawking case, it would be the opposite. You would have almost no suppression for an enormous universe and lots of suppression for a tiny one.
And then the target was important, right?
That's right, yes. Yes. Now, this diagram also you know, shows what the problem is with the Euclidean path integral. Starting with the Euclidean integral would simply mean that we have the same integral, but what we consider as the fundamental integration contour would be not along the real n line, but along the imaginary n line, either maybe the whole line or just half of it. In either case, you see, you always reach a region, one of these red regions of divergence. So the integrand simply diverges, either in going to up to infinity here or in going to near zero from below here. And so the integral, so the Euclidean integral is simply divergent, and there's nothing you can do about it. So it's simply mathematically ill-defined. It cannot be deformed. You cannot deform it to make it convergent.
Is this the same as the conformal factor problem?
Yes. This is the same as the conformal factor problem, yes. This comes precisely from that. Now, a comment about the Hartle-Hawking result. You could, the Hartle-Hawking, you get the Hartle-Hawking prefactor if you consider not the saddle point up here, but the one down here. Exponent, sorry. the Hartle-Hawking weighting, you get it from this saddle point, or in fact from these two saddle points in the lower half plane, but not from the ones in the upper half plane. And so, in fact, you might try to just construct your theory such that you just obtain these saddle points as an approximation. And for this, you can take a contour which runs below n equals 0, where there's an essential singularity. And then you would, in deforming this contour, in fact, you would pick up contributions from all four saddle points. When you flow down from that contour, see that contour here includes the divergent region, and so you can get arbitrarily large contributions, even when flowing down from it. And so you can now include contributions, in fact, from all four. So the final integral contour would, over Lefschetz thimbles, would run over the first one, second saddle point, it would come back up here through this one, and out through the top one.
So what would happen if instead of running in the red region, you ran in the green region, the deformation?
Yeah, well, you don't really have a choice how to deform it. You have to deform it by downwards flows until you reach a Lefschetz thimble.
Right, your region.
And then you
went in the original contour?
Yeah, the original contour, right.
Then you only get a two. Then you only get that one.
You mean if you go up above here?
Right.
Yeah, then you only get the two, then you would get the two upper Lefschetz thimbles here. Yeah. But this contour leads to a number of problems, which I think Neil would be happy to discuss at some point if there is interest in that. Okay, let me say maybe in slightly more detail
one problem, which is that in divergent region, and therefore there's a problem.
Yes,
okay.
That's one problem, but there are more severe problems.
Long list of problems. When you start from Lorentzian, I mean, one problem is it's not Lorentzian.
Right, of course.
When you
we never liked it.
And if you depart from Lorentzian, this opens up many, many other problems.
So when you do it wrong, you're
seeing
it wrong.
You see,
I think you no need to shoot the immigrants.
We're trying to be generous.
Just to show a bit more clearly what the difference is between this saddle point singled out by Picard-Lefschetz theory and the saddle point that Hartle and Hawking would have wanted to get. You see, in the complex time plane, you would just follow a different path for these two solutions. And let me rotate it to show the way that's normally shown by Hartle and Hawking, where the Euclidean direction is on the horizontal line. What it really means is the two solutions are sort of complex conjugates of each other. The geometry is the same. The real geometry looks the same. But in fact, the two solutions are complex conjugates of each other. So in other words, you just do a different, you could think of it as starting with the same Lorentzian evolution, but then going in a different imaginary time direction to round off the geometry. Now, okay, so now let me include perturbations. So in a sense, so far, everything has worked very well. We get a precise definition of the propagator from zero size to a late time large universe. But with the perturbation, it turns out that it doesn't work out so smoothly. That's what I want to review now. So here we'll, at first, just consider linearized perturbations. So we add a quadratic action for perturbations, phi. This, you can think of this as a gravitational wave in the Sitter space with different wave numbers, L. Okay. And for gravitational waves, L would start at 2 and then run up to infinity in integer values. Also, there's a very convenient on-shell form for the action, which is just given by the difference of two surface terms. Now, it turns out that the equation of motion for the perturbations can just be solved. Here is the solution in physical time, TP. So I'm not using that special form of the metric that I used earlier, but I'm just solving for it in physical time here. And there's these two linearly independent solutions. And one can just try and figure out the coefficients by imposing regularity. So at first, I'm looking at perturbations, assuming as a small perturbation of the background. So I'm assuming the saddle point of the background. And I just want a solution which is regular at the bottom of the instanton, meaning that the fluctuation has to be zero at the bottom of the instanton. One of these solutions will give zero fluctuation at the bottom. The other one gives infinity. So we're just choosing the one which gives zero, such that we get a finite action contribution. And this means choosing the solution called proportional to C1, the one in the first line here. And then you can just calculate the action at the saddle point for the perturbations. And at large scale factor, it's given by this formula up here. And so again, it has a fast oscillating term, which is as expected for classical fluctuations. We're imposing that the final fluctuation takes a real value, so it has become a classical fluctuation at late times. And it has, again, this this weighting factor here. And if you look at it, you see actually it comes with the wrong sign. So the weighting of the fluctuations doesn't go as e to the, like a Gaussian fluctuation, like a Gaussian distribution. It goes like an inverse Gaussian distribution. So it goes like L cubed times phi 1 squared, where phi 1 is the final value of the fluctuation. In other words, the fluctuations are more and more likely as they are bigger and bigger. So instead of getting such a smooth picture of the universe coming from the no-boundary geometry, actually what you get is something which is wildly divergent.
Just to make sure that... So this was done as a fluctuation of the Lorentzian geometry, right? You
think that of the Lorentzian path integral, well, that's
Lorentzian
right.
Path integral, right, exactly.
Yes.
But
simply imposing that at late times we get a fluctuation phi 1 with wave number L. And then you find that the fluctuations have this particular weighting. And so which is just completely out of control.
Here, are you doing first the saddle point approximation of the Q?
At this point, yes. Yes, here I'm just doing the, as a, yes, that's right.
Not just Q, never, Q and N.
Q and N, and then at the saddle point, I'm just adding the perturbations. Nevertheless, you see that you can have quite small amplitudes of fluctuations, but for high L modes, this is nevertheless a large factor. But we do more, yes. Now, there's a question of why would we get such a wrong sign, why would we get these wrong sign fluctuations? And one, yes?
The question you've asked here is the amplitude to produce this mode in a specific, it's like a position space. If this had been x rather than phi,
yes.
You're asking for the amplitude to get x rather than to find it in its vacuum. Is that right? You're not asking for it to get in its vacuum.
No, it's not to be in its vacuum state. You're asking for the amplitude to get...
To get a particular fluctuation around this geometry.
A particular three geometry.
Yeah, but as a perturbation of the saddle point that we get from just calculating the background.
Yeah, but the boundary condition, the bottom was
just fine.
Yeah, so such that it's compatible, really, with the saddle point approximation for the background.
And that's why you cannot control this phi one.
No, there's a boundary condition, and that fixes it uniquely.
Oh, that does fix it uniquely. Yes. This finite action fixes it uniquely.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Yes.
If you were doing that for free field, you would find the right vacuum.
Yeah, but then you would allow yourself to put anything at the bottom.
Yes.
But
so
here we need
the
background. Yes.
It's on all complex. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's chosen a path to the complex, which is exactly the opposite of the liquidation.
But if I just rescale phi by 2 times phi, the action would still be finite.
Oh, no, you fixed phi on
the final. Yes. You see these two solutions. One of them gives, so the background value is at where this factor is minus I. This cinch factor is minus I. Now, then you see one of these, when this is minus I, you see you get 1 minus 1 to some positive power. It is 0. But this one has 1 minus 1 to some negative power in it. And it will be infinite, right? So you have to just kill off this one. Yeah.
So
you have the choice between 0 and infinity. And you choose 0 to make it regular.
Yeah, and the normalization is fixed, as Neil said, by fixing that.
By fixing the final value. Yes, but then, of course, that's an arbitrary value, right? Now, why do we get this unsuppressed waiting for the fluctuations? One way to understand this is to realize that, like I was saying earlier, the background fixes you to take a different path in the complex time plane. And so this it kind of fixes the Wick rotation that you have to do. And it just turns out that for the Picard-Lefschetz point, it's just the opposite direction of the usual Wick rotation that you would do for convergence. You're forced to do the wrong Wick rotation, and then you get this unsuppressed result. That's one way of seeing it.
In a sense, it's all obvious because gravity has a negative kinetic term. So if you do the Wick rotation for the background.
Yes, so in a sense it's yes.
It's the wrong one for the fluctuations.
Right. The kinetic term for the scale factor has the opposite sign of the kinetic term for the fluctuations. Picard-Lefschetz theory then instructs you to choose the sign such that the background gives you a suppressed probability, and then automatically the probability for the fluctuations becomes unsuppressed.
But this sort of goes to the question that Laurent was asking about. So what would happen if you did the whole thing together, right? Mm-hmm. You start with
yeah, so I will get to that in a minute.
what I wanted to say is you made the argument before. Picard-Lefschetz just always take care of itself. So you have a real integral. It should be always smaller than one. So
it's more complicated than that.
Okay.
Actually, it turns out to be that's
so
what we
if
thought.
If you find something bigger than one, it means that you're
this is what
the wrong setup.
Hang on, you will see in a minute, okay?
What is that so much bigger than one? Because it goes e to the minus one.
Yeah, there's the one
plus.
So it's exactly, there's a competition now.
Exactly. Yeah.
So as long as you're in a certain regime, small fluctuation.
Well, yeah, it gets a little more complicated, as you will see in a minute. Let me just say that all of this goes through also for slow roll inflation. So we've done this. This is now I'm presenting everything for pure de Sitter space, but you can easily extend this for slow roll inflation. For instance, when you take a Hilltop potential like this, and everywhere where I had lambda, you would replace it by V of phi, and then the whole thing still goes through.
But with the plus sign,
Yes, with the wrong sign.
With the wrong
sign.
Sorry? What happened if I had just the quadratic potential? M squared phi squared.
Oh, I mean, as long as it's the roll, it will still go through. Yeah. This is sort of the Hilbert potential is easy to do the calculation because we know we can do the background exactly for the sitter space, and so one can easily do a fluctuation around the sitter space here to go get to slow roll. For the M squared phi squared, you would have to do the approximate but it's the same. It's
you're
just
saying if we had a positive mass for the scalar, of course we wouldn't get an end of inflation, so it couldn't be a slow roll model.
No, but then you could have a positive, but you would have to be at large field values to get slow roll.
Right, but we'd still have the problem with the graviton having the wrong distribution. I mean, the previous calculation was the graviton.
Right.
So nothing works.
So let me do it slightly more rigorously. So instead of just doing the background fully and then adding the perturbations later, you can ask, well, can we have a solution for the fluctuations everywhere in the complex n plane before doing the integral over n? And it turns out one can. It's just the solutions are a bit more complicated. They're given by this function of time here, which has these exponents, which are also more complicated. But the point is that for each value of the Laplace function n, there exists one finite action solution. There is some subtlety because of these square roots that are involved. So one has to define this carefully. It turns out one has to define, So having these solutions, we can just calculate the action that one gets, so the perturbation action in terms of the Laplace function n. But it turns out one has to define it very carefully in the upper and lower half planes because of these square roots. And it turns out that the action actually has a branch cut. So there are these branch points, n star plus and n star minus, given by these values here, which depend on the wave number L. And these values lie on the real n axis. Yes. So there are two solutions at every...
At large n. The square root is always positive.
Yes.
Okay,
that's right.
It should be n squared minus n squared.
No. So there are two branch points. There are two branch points, and the branch cut lies only in between. And that's very small n and very large, and there's no ambiguity.
Okay, yeah. So it's just.
That's right. It's a finite length branch cut. Yes. It's a very peculiar situation. So there are these two branch points. They lie on the real n axis, and they surround these paths of steepest ascent and descent always. So now there is this branch cut here, right? And so let me just go back for a second. Yes.
Because they cut the paths which are ambiguous, the one that we're both
correct. Also, yes. Yeah. So now this branch cut. Now we have the perturbed action. As a first check, one can just do the perturbation around the saddle point of the background, whether it agrees with our earlier results, and it's easy to see that it does. Okay, this is, of course, as expected. What one can also do is now expand around other points. There's a particular point of interest, which is this point n star, which lies just where the branch cut intersects these lines of steepest ascent and descent. It turns out that that point is actually the saddle point of the perturbed action considered alone. So if you were to consider very large fluctuations where only the perturbed action is relevant, the saddle point would be this one here, and not these two points here. Or in other words, as you turn up the fluctuations, as you make them bigger and bigger, the saddle points will start moving towards this branch cut. And so now one can also expand the action around this special point n star. But now there isn't a unique expansion. It depends on whether you come from above or below because you have the cut there. And in fact, it turns out that if you come from above, you again have this unsuppressed waiting for the fluctuations, which again goes as L cubed phi 1 squared. And when you come from below, you have the opposite one. So this shows that the action, actually the total action, a total weighting can become unlike what I said earlier, that you have to flow down always from zero and you must get a negative probability. It turns out that actually this branch cut means that this argument is no longer true at the location of the branch cut. The action becomes the Morse function becomes very large above the branch cut, and it becomes very small below.
So this is a branch cut which is along the usual, the real axis.
Yes,
here, right?
This is a this is a real. I would say this is a real problem for the theory.
So it means originally the theory is not defined. What is
it's not very well defined. That's right. That's right. It's not very well defined. So in fact, you would have to. You have to, in fact, choose whether you want to go above or below, right? You have to now make a choice.
Original action, it's not completely clear.
No, it's not clear. But regardless of how you do it, in the first case, if you go above, you get the usual Lefschetz symbol above here that we had earlier with all the problems. If you go below, you get an additional contribution from going around the branch cut and then flowing up to the saddle point. It turns out now you have two problematic contributions. So it turns out that what you get from going around the branch cut is again a term similar to the one you get from the Lefschetz symbol above. So in fact, without suppression, unsuppressed fluctuations.
It's not due to an order of integration. If you try to do the other order, you're going to get a different picture.
Is the branch cut that classically non-Lyot region? Is that what it is?
No.
Sorry. Okay. There are two questions.
The first question is about like this is very dependent on the fact that you decide to fix n and look at.
That's right. That's because
maybe
we can do it.
Maybe the
rhythm yes.
Might be.
Yeah.
And you can get a different picture. There.
Maybe a heuristic way of explaining it. So when you solve a pi equation, one solution which is regular.
Yeah.
Each point on the n-plane. One which is singular.
Yeah.
So on one Riemann sheet, you've got the regular guy, and on the other Riemann sheet is the other guy. And so we choose to throw away the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the branch cut is exactly the boundary between the regular and the regular. So that's where the two Riemann sheets collide.
Now I see that. But I'm thinking, suppose now you try to solve for n in terms of phi instead of phi in terms of n. Then it's a different.
Right.
Order. I mean, usually
yes.
When you solve polynomial equations, it's
yes.
You know, if one is quadratic
yes.
And cubic, it might
yeah. Okay.
I don't know the answer.
Well,
it might change the picture.
Well, analytically, we do it this way. Numerically, we can also just look for saddle points of the full action.
Okay.
No, actually, we've done that. I'm going to come to that. and it supports these results.
Just a quick elementary question. I mean, this is the question about the infinite dimensions now, right? You are looking at perturbations. This
yes.
Was so it's really infinite dimensional table you are doing.
Well,
no, you can choose a single mode.
But even for an L, isn't there R?
It's a single, that's just like adding one field.
But you're not doing the determinant yet, right? That's the. You're taking E the action and you're evaluating the action and you're telling us what the answer is, but you haven't done the determinant which would be the fluctuation around yet.
Right.
That's not difficult.
But that's where the problem normally is when the fluctuations and the need to normalize, all that stuff will happen in the determinant.
Yeah.
So you won't, if you don't do the determinant, you won't see that problem.
Yeah.
Well, we have enough problems as it is.
I don't want it. The determinant tells you that the semi-classical right. Approximation relies on a large, having a large radius compared to the Planck size, which you could do. I mean, you could have a big considered based on it.
Yeah,
then,
I mean, these problems don't seem to be related to any of those issues.
No,
what are you worried about? No. Worried about zero thought.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No,
free field. This
right.
The issue is the validity of the saddle point approximation. So the thing is, the determinant is the fluctuation around that, and it's the accumulation of the many, many modes that are fluctuating that is part of the problem.
I see. So you're worried about some one loop effect completely modifying the
right.
Lagrangian.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's true. We have to worry about that.
So, mm-hmm. As you said, there's a bunch of problems that you're focusing on some, and we're just
that's
trying
right.
To get clarity about what
yes,
we're focusing
that's
on.
Right.
Here.
Yes. So this is more or less what I was saying earlier. If you calculate the action approaching from above and from below the branch cut, you see that it just grows. And this is kind of a failure of the usual principle that when we let h bar go to zero, that we expect to recover classical results. This is no longer true here because some contributions just blow up. So this is a clear problem of this theory. Now, to come back to the question of how reliable these calculations are, we've done also some numerical checks. This is now in particular for the L equals 2 modes, so just for the quadrupole. The analytic result is the formula which I showed earlier, that for larger phi, the weighting just grows because of the instability of the fluctuations. This is now the total action background plus fluctuations. Now, we can do the calculation including back reaction, but still in linear perturbation theory, where we consider the fluctuation modes to be linear, but we look at the back reaction they have on the scale factor. Turns out this has an extremely tiny effect, essentially no effect. So we recover the same results. And for this case, we can also do the fully nonlinear calculation, because the L equals 2 mode, this is really the fully perturbed solution is just a Bianchi 9 metric. And we can do the numerical analysis with the full Bianchi 9 metric, so solving the full Einstein equations numerically. And this is given by the green line here. And what we find is simply that the instability is even stronger. So it just sets in a bit earlier.
Should you emphasize the complex Einstein equations we're solving?
Yeah, these are the saddle points. So these are complex solutions with the given boundary conditions that we impose. And so these problems with perturbations cannot be avoided by choosing other contours, which I just want to mention here, but I don't have time to discuss it in detail. But essentially, there is no, as far as we can see, there is no contour that you can cook up, whether it's related to physical motivations or not. There is simply no contour which avoids these problems.
Can you say what the problem was? I got lost in the...
Oh, that the fluctuations are unsuppressed.
The amplitude was running into the eye.
So that you will always get an additional contribution from the fluctuations, which makes the whole thing break down.
So fluctuations are not Gaussian distributed, they're anti-Gaussian.
Yes. So the idea is that there might be other saddle points. You might try and deform your contour such that you pick up other saddle points, hoping that these will not have this problem. So, for instance, as I was saying earlier, these saddle points down here, they give you the Hartle-Hawking result for the background. It turns out they have suppressed fluctuations. So you could think, I will modify my theory such that I only pick up these. The background might be strange, but the fluctuations should be well-behaved. It turns out that it doesn't work. If you apply Picard-Lefschetz theory, you realize that no matter how you choose your contour, you always pick up contributions from these upper saddle points and from the branch cut as well. You cannot avoid that. And so you just cannot evade this problem of unbounded fluctuations.
But you know, why is the back reaction small? Did you say it's small or not?
You should think of this as this is the full result will be a sum of terms. Now, for an individual term, the back reaction is small. But if you choose this saddle point where the perturbations are suppressed, there will be an additional term in the path integral which comes from the saddle points where the fluctuations are unsuppressed. Now, in each term, the back reaction is small. But this other term still, the unsuppressed term still gets unboundedly large.
So by each term, you mean for each L, is it?
Okay? I mean for each saddle point, around each saddle. So each, yes. Along each thimble, let's say,
yeah.
Along each thimble, the back reaction is small. But
even
you get a sum of these thimbles.
Even though the amplitude is growing exponentially.
That's right.
So how do you understand that? Because
nonlinearly, the back reaction is not small.
Uh-huh.
It's just... when we do back reaction, keeping the perturbations only to linear order, then the back reaction is small. But if we keep, so as I was saying for this L equals 2 case, if we keep the back reaction with the full nonlinear theory, you see now it really becomes more and more pronounced.
But maybe you should emphasize that the point at which it's very pronounced is the point where the Picard-Lefschetz symbol has overtaken.
Yeah, as soon as you cross this line, you're already in trouble. I mean, then already the Picard-Lefschetz saddle points have overtaken the Hartle-Hawking saddle points, and then the model makes no sense anymore. And this only, the point at which you overtake it, is shown, is becomes, here this is shown for higher and higher L, starting with L equals 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And you see, for higher L, it just happens earlier. You just, it just, so where these two lines cross is where the Picard-Lefschetz saddle point overtakes the Hartle-Hawking saddle point. And this just happens for smaller and smaller values of the fluctuations as the wave number gets bigger. So I'm out of time.
Just so I understand the punchline, this is a criticism of those guys who have the contour at the bottom.
Yes, that's right.
No, it's not a problem. And if you do it the way you were originally proposing.
Well, then you have a problem from the beginning. You only have the single saddle point, which is already has the unsuppressed fluctuations.
Oh, I see.
The question is now, can you try and modify your theory such that you have other saddle points which have well-behaved fluctuations? And you can try and do that, but these unsuppressed saddle points may, you know, come back at you and cannot really be avoided. So I wanted to mention that this was all for replacing, not talking about the bounds. You can consider similar solutions, complex saddle points of the action going from a contracting to an expanding universe, so where you have a sort of a quantum bounds. And let me just mention that one can find such solutions. These were published in a paper with Sebastian Bramberger, Thomas Hertog, and Yannick Vreese. And you have to choose some particular delicate path in the complex time plane, but these solutions exist. However, they also, we have some preliminary indications that they might have similar problems with perturbations. So that, again, there might in fact be a selection criterion which tells you what kind of such bounces are allowed and which are not allowed. I think that's quite interesting to pursue because we want, you know, it certainly doesn't seem likely that anything is allowed. And this might be a good selection criterion to see what makes more sense.
What does it mean, what kind?
Sorry?
What kind of bounce are allowed? So how are you distinguishing this bounce system?
Okay, so these are the solutions that we found so far are in an inflationary potential, m squared phi squared potential, going from an unstable contracting inflationary phase to an expanding inflationary phase, also assuming that the spatial section is closed. And the second set of solutions go from an ekparotic contracting phase to an expanding inflationary phase. We choose these because these are attractors and they make it easier to actually find such solutions because you have to make sure that the boundary values are real. The fields have to be real at the boundaries of your transition. And this is much easier to do if you have an attractor model. If you have something which is otherwise, I don't know of any examples so far where you don't have where such solutions exist without an attractor.
So k equals 1 is what you're...
And they all have k equals 1, yes.
Is the scale of the bounce unique, or you can choose whatever you want?
You can choose different transitions between different scale factors, but given that, there is always one solution which has the highest probability. And this will then give you the scale of the bounds, the most likely scale of the bounds. But really what we're finding is that also one can have this situation where nevertheless the fluctuations are unsuppressed. And so that there must be something wrong with these solutions then. Okay, so I think the main lesson from this is that the background and the perturbations must be considered together in a quantum setting. There is no way you can impose a classical background and just look at quantum fluctuations. And our results indicate that the universe cannot have had a smooth beginning. And this means that the Big Bang must be faced head on. And in fact, that the question of initial conditions is still wide open as far as I can see. So there's plenty of us for us to think about. Thank you. Yes.
Your second point, the universe is not a smooth beginning, that's because you're ascribing the problems to the fact that you chose a smooth boundary condition.
Yes, that's right. Yes. This is not saying anything about, say if you take a flat geometry, then you wouldn't have such a smooth beginning. You would run into an actual singularity. You wouldn't be able to have a finite curvature beginning, in a sense. Right. This is not saying anything about that, but then, of course, you run into the problem that you need to describe that large curvature regime. I think the main attraction of the no-boundary idea was that you might be able to get away with finite curvature, and then you wouldn't have to know about UV, about, you know, what eventually quantum gravity is, that this semi-classical quantum gravity would be enough. And I think that's not, that this is showing this is not true.
And also these integrals are done with standard general relativity action.
Yeah, but if the curvature is finite and not too large, this would have been fine. You know, had it worked, it would have been within the regime where you would trust relativity.
I don't like it.
Yeah, that was the hope.
So, just as a side remark,
yes.
We can discuss it later. So, I mean, when there was a bounce in loop quantum cosmology, Bukhana kept asking me, but how can it be because of the path integrals? Because if I just looked at path integrals and the action is very large, and then the statement was that near the singularity, and then usually quantum effects are important when the action is compared to H bar, so what happens?
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at it in great detail. And then what happens basically, so what one can do is one can just take the loop quantum cosmology model as quantum mechanics and repeat kind of slightly modified version of what Feynman had done to recast into the path integral. It has to be slightly different because it's timeless, it's a constraint system and so on. But
yes.
It has been done. And then what one finds is that in order to, that quantum mechanics of loop quantum cosmology, actually what it does is to change the action. In other words, there's a quantum correction in the action already. If I want to reproduce my path integrals, what I got from quantum mechanics,
mm-hmm.
the action has to be changed. So first it looks very surprising to us, but then I remember ancient days and found the paper. This was a paper by Bryce David. He was just considering a very simple case. And that case was really a particle moving in a free particle on a Riemannian manifold. So therefore, you know, the action is just GABPAPB or actually GAB times there's a mass term times Q dot A, Q dot B, etc. And then of course, quantum mechanically, the operator will be just with the covariant Laplacian with respect to that metric, so you can solve it. And then he was trying to see what happens in path integral to get the same answer as on quantum
right.
mechanics. And he found that to get the same answer in quantum mechanics, you have to modify the action to the classical action plus
yes.
some term like h bar squared by 12 times
Rigid
of it. You remember that?
On
okay.
superspace.
On superspace.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so this does happen. Right? So that's another. This is very beautiful.
But this is related to the ordering issue also.
So, yeah.
If you have a curved superspace, it can happen. It doesn't happen in the cosmos.
It doesn't happen in the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yes.
If you have curved configuration space,
exactly.
then this can happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we found that the loop quantum cosmology thing is correct, giving
exactly.
a specific quantum correction.
Is that where the extra term comes from?
You can.
The minus rho term?
Right. You can start from that action then. And then see what happens. That extra terms come from there. I mean, it's all consistency, right? Depends on where you start.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sort of a thing to keep in mind. I mean,
right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very
yes.
beautiful. It's all stuff.
So we haven't corrected the action in any way.
No.
Right. Now it's. But, it's good to have clean results, and then one can see what they mean.
Sure, of course. One can try also to see what if there are any loopholes in them.
Or generalization.
Yes.
Right, so you didn't have time to talk about the bouncing scenarios, but can you avoid this second problem, the problem about a smooth beginning if you get a bounce? So the problem that the background gives one side of the exponent of and the fluctuations the other side. So can
I don't know yet. Because, like I said, we have some examples where the problems seem to be there. I don't know what one has to do to avoid it.
So the problem seems to come from two things, which were both the motivation of the Hubble proposal, namely that you have some sort of vacuum energy, secondly, that you have a
closed geometry. So Hartle-Hawking found that very appealing because then everything was sort of naturally compact and finite. And those two things are the origin of the problem.
Yeah. Now, we, it might be that by changing one of these, you can avoid it. Yes.
We seem to get the bad.
Now, you can, you cannot, if you make the spatial section flat, you cannot rescue the no boundary idea because you run into high curvature regimes, but you might be able to rescue the bounces because there it's fine to have a flat spatial section.
That's right. And your theory works fine.
Yeah.
Yes.
You might work with even compact topology for that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Like
E3 for this kind of set.
But you're left with the question where the universe comes from.
I think it's better to have two things then.
Oh, yeah, that doesn't have to be resolved this year. That's fine.
It's taken us 14 billion
yeah.
years to realize this.
So. Besides, maybe this I mean, Hartle-Hawking is a proposal that this is really a beginning. There's still, I mean, you can still ask the question, what is the probability to go from a regular universe to, you know, a quark or to zero universe? And then you need to be
yes.
able to tell me, I don't know, the probability is zero or infinite or, I mean,
right.
so in some sense, there should be a definite answer to that question, right? And ultimately, so maybe your techniques might, because as much as you're saying, maybe it's not the right picture, there still should be a number attached to that question.
I think if you phrase it that way, what's
yeah.
the probability of the universe annihilating?
Yes.
In the future?
Yes.
We have an answer.
Okay.
This is the answer. So whatever the gravitational waves are on today's 3 geometry,
yes.
Okay, but then
because for a given boundary, you get a finite result. It's just that when you consider now let the emergence of the universe and you look at different fluctuations, you have having more fluctuations gets more and more likely. That's the trouble.
Yes, so exactly.
But if you take the current universe and you say, what's the probability of it vanishing into nothing,
yeah.
you get a finite answer.
So would you telling me that if, let's say, the amplitude of phi, so if I take a root of the phi value, the amplitude of phi is bigger than, I don't know, 3/λ, some scale set up by the cosmic
yeah.
Then it's becoming the most likely
that's right.
process.
That's right.
Okay.
The universe can be.
So
I mean,
if I put too much matter, then it just collapses to a point. Is that the way
no,
I should? Or
no,
it becomes,
no,
or the probability that
very,
it happens is
this
phenomena?
Very quantum. Yeah, this is very quantum. So if you want to take our given 3 geometry today
yes.
and ask what is the probability that the universe contracts to
mm-hmm.
one going forward? One way to do it, just to prescribe today's 3 geometry. Probably that's not the best way. You should put in the expansion rate and so on. But very crudely, you would do that. And then we would have e to the minus 1/λ, which is e to the minus 10^120.
Yeah, so it's very
small. But then we'd have e to the plus phi squared.
Yeah, but
so
these would be quite small.
So is it, you're talking about the future?
Yeah, I'm
future.
Talking about us and our
okay.
About the whole universe just tunneling into nothing.
Also
but then you're saying it's more than you get.
It's
e to
the
minus. If you're above
yes.
a critical density, then we're going to end up there.
Yes,
yeah.
But also the fact that our universe is expanding is something to do with that, so that will also suppress it.
Right.
Okay, and what if we ask about the past? You were talking about
well,
if yes, where we're becoming from, what is the
probability to get our universe? The problem is that it's exceeded by the probability for the same universe with larger fluctuation. Because our answer goes like e to the minus 1/λ plus h squared.
Yeah.
So as you increase the h on the final 3 geometry, it gets more and more likely.
But what I'm saying is that does that give us some kind of observational, like.
Yeah, it just says the universe should be dominated.
Yeah, so the,
if we come from that,
if
so
we come from a no boundary,
if we come from zero, we should be only. And
for
the fact that we're matter dominating means we come from somewhere else.
Correct.
Okay, so that's the way.
Correct.
Okay,
exactly.
So that's a physical.
So
it's not wrong. It just means that it separates
so
different
what,
universes.
Exactly. So what seems to rescue us from this disaster is if the early universe is dominated by radiation. Then we have a classical solution.
Yes, yes.
Taking us from
okay.
zero science all the way to the
so if we take the data, which
yeah,
we put the numbers.
We're in a good universe.
So we appreciate it. We use we can start from nothing, or
yes.
we
you could imagine starting from nothing.
Okay.
Providing you have radiation. And secondly, providing it seems this is preliminary, providing the universe did not re-collapse classically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that would have required quantum tunneling to get us
yeah,
out.
Yeah. So I'm just saying if
yeah.
I take a face value
so
your number and
at
do that
value
out,
the universe looks good.
Okay.
Okay.
That's good. So, okay. Could be a selection. So this is a selection criteria
yeah, exactly.
In some sense. Like
exactly.
Not every universes are acceptable.
Sure.
Absolutely.
That's good.
That's right.
That's great.
Good. Yes.
That's great.
So we need to learn. Is this branch curve is a selection principle of these kinds
yeah,
of points?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Good. That sounds like a great conclusion within the universe. Universe selection.
And thanks, Jean-Luc, again.